Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm Amarnath Amarasingham, and I will be co-hosting this podcast periodically along with Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that is especially interesting and we chat with the author of the book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Reza Aslan about his highly popular and beautifully written new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, published by Random House in 2013. Zealot has shot to the bestseller list in recent weeks, partly due to a controversial interview Reza Aslan gave to Fox News, during which he was questioned about why a Muslim would be interested in writing a book about the founder of Christianity. Christians in the United States and around the world have varying images of Jesus, from one who turns the other cheek to one who brings the sword. Aslan approaches Jesus by first taking the context in which he lived, which is first century Palestine, quite seriously. Aslan argues that Jesus' time was one awash in a fervent nationalism that is important for understanding the man as well as his message. It's not a book about Jesus of the Gospels. Indeed, it is not even a book about Christianity. Rather, Aslan's book attempts to grapple with how Jesus understood himself and his role during a volatile period in history. We also talked to Reza about his earlier books, No God But God and How to Win a Cosmic War, as well as his two edited collections, Tablet and Pen and Muslims and Jews in America. We talked to him about growing up Iranian while pretending to be Mexican in the United States during the 1980s, about graduate school, about Fox News and Islamophobia, and about writing for a popular audience, being a public intellectual, and the challenges involved with such endeavors. Thanks for listening. Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. This morning I have the pleasure of talking to Reza Aslan about his great new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Good morning, Reza. I know you're just starting out your book tour, but thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So usually on this podcast, we feature authors whose books may not get that much attention in the popular media and are usually just reviewed in academic journals and so on. But your book, of course, has been on the New York Times bestseller list now for 6 weeks or so and has received a lot of attention. So I look forward to talking about it.
Yeah, thanks.
But before we get to the book, I do have, you know, some biographical questions and questions about your background. So can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? You know, where were you born, where you went to school, and how you first became interested in religion and so on?
Sure. Well, I was born in Iran. We left Iran in 1979 after the revolution. I think my father thought that it might be a good idea to leave the country temporarily while things settled down a bit. Obviously, that temporarily became permanent. I grew up mostly in the Bay Area. In the early 80s, a time in which, you know, it wasn't the best thing in the world to be Muslim or Iranian. So it was kind of one of these weird things where, I felt as though I had to kind of hide my religion and my culture and ethnicity and kind of as much as possible absorb into American culture. Didn't really grow up with much religious or spiritual training at all. Went to high school where I joined an evangelical youth group that I heard the gospel story for the very first time and converted to Christianity and really kind of threw my entire life into missionizing the gospels. Went to undergrad at Santa Clara University, a fine Jesuit institution, and there I began my formal study of the New Testament. And, you know, was confronted with, I think, what most people in my situation are confronted with, which is that I learned that a lot of the stuff that I thought I knew about Jesus was incorrect, and began to be much more interested in the historical Jesus, this man who lived 2,000 years ago, than in the Christ that I had been taught about in church. And although I left Christianity, I continued my studies in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament. And it was really at that point that the sort of impetus for this book arose. Went on from there, of course, and did my graduate work. I did my Master of Theological Studies in the History of Religions at Harvard and my PhD in the Sociology of Religions at Santa Barbara, and then paused along the way to get an MFA in Fiction at the Our Writers Workshop because I wanted to make sure that my writing would be up to par with my scholarship. I think, you know, you said earlier at the show that a lot of books like this don't tend to end up on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, I was aware of that 20 years ago when I went on this, and I knew why too. It was because, you know, we academics tend to write in an incredibly inaccessible fashion, and so for me, being able to share the things that I was learning with a wide popular audience was always part of the plan.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get to a little bit of that a little later, I guess. But, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, growing up Iranian and Muslim in the 80s was a bit difficult. But are there any particular experiences that stand out? Or do you mean any outright discrimination? Or was it more kind of self-censorship or internalized discrimination?
No, this was a time, I mean, you know, there were pop songs about bombing Iran and, you know... The sort of WWF wrestling was all geared towards, you know, these sort of evil Iranian figures who would be beat up, you know, and stuff. No, I mean, it was definitely a time in which it was made very clear that Iranians were not welcome in the United States. And so, as I've said before, I spent a good part of the 80s pretending to be Mexican.
how successful was that?
It turned out to be a lot more successful than I thought. You know, I kind of look Mexican. I, you know, very easily picked up Spanish. I was around a lot of, you know, Mexican immigrant communities. I even learned how to break dance. So that really allowed me to hide pretty well.
Yeah, breakdancing is key, I guess.
Yeah, that is key.
So looking at some of your early graduate education, as you mentioned, so you had an initial focus on kind of the scholarly study of Christianity, but then you moved to a more scholarly study of Islam or a sociology of Islam to some degree. Would that be accurate? And if so, what kind of led to that shift in focus?
Well, not exactly. I mean, none of my degrees are in Islam per se. All of my degrees are in the study of religion, but my specialty is Western religions, and Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Those are the religions that I've spent the most time studying. But as I always like to say, you know, Islam pays the bills. That's the religion that people want to know most about. That's the religion that I get a lot of my, salary from talking about it and teaching. But it wasn't a thing where it's like, you know, I suddenly switched to Christianity. I mean, the Abrahamic religions are where my specialty lies.
So you've always been interested in the Abrahamic religions, and so I guess that's a good segue to talking briefly about your first book. Did you write No God But God while in graduate school?
I did. And if,
Yeah. And if so, how on earth did you find the time to do that?
You know, I mean, I didn't sleep for about 2 years or so. I did. I wrote No God But God while I was finishing my PhD, which actually was not a good thing. I mean, it did not exactly endear me to my professors and my colleagues, as you can imagine. Especially when it became a hit. That made life much, much worse. For me, you know, there was a lot of kind of, well, you know, who do you think you are, kid? And I understand that. I mean, you know, I completely get where that sentiment comes from. But no, it was one of these things where I was given the opportunity to write this book, and it became something that I couldn't pass up. At the same time, I was so deeply immersed in my graduate work that there was no way I could take a pause. So I just had to do both at once.
Why did you decide to write an introduction or a history of Islam at that particular point?
It was my agent's idea. I mean, honestly, this is kind of a funny story, which is that I had written a novel and while in my MFA program, and that novel got some interest from an agent in New York. And she was about to, this is like 2003. She was about to go out with that novel to sell it to publishers when she casually asked me, do I have any other books in mind? And I said, well, yes, I do. I have a number of book ideas, both fiction and nonfiction. And for instance, I have this one book idea that I have about Islam. And it was like dollar signs popped up in her eyes, like a cartoon. She said, what do you mean? Islam? What are you talking about? What about Islam? Because this was, of course, like I said, 2002, 2003. Right. And I gave her sort of the elevator pitch for what would become No God But God. And she was so excited about it that she tabled the novel and just sold the No God But God instead. Which, you know, in hindsight was a good idea. But again, it goes back to what I'm saying, which is that, you know, although I do a number of different things and I consider myself, adept at different disciplines and fields, all anyone ever wants to hear about or talk about is Islam. And I get it.
And you're perfectly willing to provide it.
I am perfectly willing to accommodate that, yes.
But so is there a similar story behind your second book, the How to Win a Cosmic War, or was that more?
As a matter of fact, there is. All right, so I guess we're going to get into this then, since this is a podcast about books. I like that. So No God But God came out. It was wildly successful. I mean, more successful than I think anyone thought it would be. And it was time for the next book, and I said, okay, well, now it's time to publish the novel that I'd worked on, which was supposed to be the first book anyway. And Random House said, yeah, that's cute. What about another book just like this one? I said, okay, fine. So I wrote How to Win a Cosmic War, which is about religion and violence in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And I said, okay, well, I did what you asked, and now it's time to publish the novel. And they said, yeah, well, my agent actually was smart enough to, they wanted the Jesus book, pretty badly. And my agent was smart enough to write into the contract that if they publish the Jesus book, then they have to publish the novel. And so my next book will finally be that novel, which at this point has to be rewritten because, as I often say, novels aren't like Twinkies. They have a shelf life.
Yeah. So your actual first book will end up being your fourth book.
Right, exactly. But, it's a testimony to the publishing industry. I mean, I did not know this because, you know, I read a lot of fiction, but apparently Americans don't buy fiction at all.
Yeah. They buy things you can read on the subway, which is Harlequin and...
Right. So I should say literary fiction. Yes, they don't buy literary fiction for the most part.
Was How to Win a Cosmic War based on your dissertation at all?
It was. And that was, the key, I think, to being successful in multiple fields is what I like to call double dipping. And so, yes, indeed, my dissertation, which was about jihadism as a social movement, which was, like most dissertations, completely unreadable. I did a very simplified version of that that became How to Win a Cosmic War.
And I guess another book that has received some positive press, or quite a lot of positive press, is Tablet and Pen, which is an anthology of modern Middle Eastern literature.
Yeah.
It's an edited book volume, or I guess all anthologies are edited, but I mean, how did that book come about?
That book was a real passion project, something that I've been working on for a really long time. I'm a board member in an organization called Words Without Borders. We're a nonprofit that takes literature in every genre you can imagine, from all over the world, in every language that you can imagine. We get its rights. We translate it professionally, usually not by professional translators, but by poets and writers who are multilingual, to maintain sort of its literary quality as much as possible. And then we put it on our site, wordswithoutborders.org, for free for anyone to use. So if you want to read, you know, Chinese poetry or Brazilian short stories, you can go onto the site and check it out. We also publish anthologies every once in a while. We did a very popular anthology called Literature from the Axis of Evil in I think 2002-2003. We've done anthologies of Chinese dissident writing, things like that. And when the board came to me and said, you know, we'd really like to do an anthology of Middle Eastern writing, would you be interested in editing it? I jumped at the chance to do so. This is a part of the world that is steeped in literature. I mean, some of the titans of global literature come from this part of the world. And while they are globally renowned, they're just simply not all that well known or read in the English-speaking world. And I really wanted to change that, to put together an anthology that would not just introduce English readers to some of these great writers in Arabic, Turkish, Persian, and Urdu, but would be accessible again in a way that would make people who would normally not read a book like this interested in doing so. The book is called Tablet and Pen. All of the proceeds from the book, every penny that comes out of it, goes to supporting the work of Words Without Borders. And I really recommend the book for anyone interested in this region or in literature.
Right. I mean, so usually when these kinds of works are translated, they become wildly popular. It's just that no one in the English-speaking world ever gets to really know them well enough, right, or hear about them.
Right. So. And I think Words Without Borders wanted to do was to use, you know, the little bit of a platform that I had managed to get for myself to bring a kind of attention to this book that normally wouldn't be there. And it worked. I mean, I think this at one point, it was, I think, number 7 on Amazon very briefly,
right,
which for any anthology of literature is remarkable, but for an anthology of literature from the Middle East is pretty amazing. As Stephen Colbert said, if you read one anthology of Arabic poetry this year, it should be this one.
Yeah, usually anthologies and edited books don't end up on any of those.
No, no, they really do not. They really do not.
And the other edited book you have is on Jewish-Christian relations in the United States.
Yes, Muslims and Jews in America. This is edited by a colleague of mine at the University of San Francisco, Aaron Hahn Topper. Aaron and I actually met in graduate school. We were getting our PhD at the same time, and we started a dialogue group of Jews and Muslims at Santa Barbara. That ultimately became an organization that Aaron founded called Abraham's Vision. It's an attempt to create understanding amongst Jewish and Muslim, Israeli and Palestinian youth. And I became a board member of that organization. And yeah, we together put together this anthology, again, the proceeds of which go to support the organization, that was about sort of the commonalities and the complexities that are involved in relations between the Muslim and Jewish communities in the United States, two communities that have had such a similar experience of xenophobia and assimilation, and yet have not used that similarity to draw together, to form a united front. On the contrary, are most often at odds with one another instead of cooperating with each other.
Right. Yeah. So moving on to the your most recent book, would you say that, you know, the scholarly study of religion is fairly old, and the scholarly study of the historical Jesus is almost just as old? So why did you feel the need to write another book on book about Jesus?
You know, I'm not the first person to say that the conclusions that I come to in my book are not new. They're not innovative. They are, you know, conclusions based on debates that have been taking place in the historical study of Jesus for two centuries now. I am building upon the work of my colleagues and my predecessors, and essentially joining my voice in that larger debate. What is new or unique in this book is that I have taken that debate and distilled it and made it as accessible and appealing as possible to a popular audience. So, in other words, my colleagues and I would not even scratch our heads at the notion that, for instance, that, you know, Jesus was not born in Bethlehem. That's, you know, the second day of New Testament studies. You learn that.
Right.
But let's be honest, for the vast majority of people who are not biblical scholars, that is an absolutely controversial and provocative idea. So I've had it's interesting, the response that I've had from this book. On the one hand, the response from the lay reader is that, you know, this is ridiculous and provocative and deliberately controversial. And the response from my colleagues has been kind of a collective yawn, like, yeah, so. So you can't please anyone, apparently. But I think that's the important thing to understand, is that, you know, I'm proud. I'm very, very proud of, you know, certain arguments that I make in this book that are nuanced, that may be a new or interesting way of looking at topics that have been examined for two centuries. But the larger points that I make are ones that would sound very familiar to any historian of the Bible or early Christianity.
Is there an argument in the book that you feel, or is there a specific argument in the book that you feel has never been made before, or is there?
Not never been made before, but I am proud of a lot of the work that I have done, both when it comes to something that scholars refer to as the Messianic secret in Mark, which is something that I wrote my thesis on and that I had been working on for quite some time. I think I come up with some very interesting observations about how to think about the Messianic secret. And then I'm also proud of the work that I've done when it comes to understanding the notion of the Son of Man. For those unfamiliar, you know, the sort of general consensus of scholars is that the preferred term that Jesus used to describe himself was the Son of Man. The problem is that nobody has any clue what the Son of Man actually means when it was used by Jesus. In fact, nobody knows now, and nobody even knew then when Jesus used the term. He was using it, of course, as a title, not as an idiomatic expression, which is how it's most often used in the Hebrew scriptures. I sort of rely on the same principles that other scholars used, using mostly the Book of Daniel, and some Enoch studies, though I think I fall in the camp of those who believe that Enoch was a much later, certainly the similitudes of Enoch is a much, much later text than some scholars believe. And so I don't think that it was very influential to Jesus. But trying to use the Son of Man to make a larger argument about how Jesus viewed himself in a kingly role is one that I wouldn't say is completely new, but it is one that I'm particularly proud of.
Mm-hmm. And what is the scholarship around the Messianic secret you mentioned?
So the Messianic secret is something that's it's something that people have noticed for a very long time. It's this somewhat odd phenomenon that takes place primarily in the Gospel of Mark, but which then is picked up in Matthew, in Luke, in which Jesus repeatedly goes to great lengths to hide his Messianic identity, constantly forbidding anyone from telling anyone who he is, silencing demons who try to out him, forbidding people that he has healed from speaking about what he's done. There's a lot of scholarship on what this means. Some people think that it can be traced to the historical Jesus. I agree. Some people think that it's just a literary flourish of Mark's. And I think most people, those who fall in the former category, agree that the Messianic secret provides the key to unlocking Jesus's self-consciousness, what he actually thought he himself was, not what others thought he was.
And your interpretation of that is what is his self-consciousness?
Well, my interpretation of that has to do with something that is rarely spoken of when it comes to the Messianic secret, which is the collusion of Jesus's Son of Man ideas into the Messianic secret. So one thing that's interesting is that a lot of times in the Gospel of Mark, in which somebody ascribes the title of Messiah to Jesus, and he either overtly rejects that title or brushes it aside, what often follows is some kind of diatribe about the Son of Man. And so what I argue is that Jesus's interpretation of the Son of Man has to be seen as part and parcel of the Messianic secret. That, to put it in its simplest way possible, that Jesus, understanding the ramifications of the Messiah and knowing the fate that all the other would-be Messiahs in his time faced, tried to subsume others' Messianic expectations into his own unique and somewhat innovative understanding of the Son of Man as a kingly figure. And so in a sense, Jesus was referring to himself as king.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of your interpretation of the Son of Mark. Son of Man.
Yes, that's right. That this is Jesus' way of obliquely declaring his kingly ambitions.
Right. But it's not really that argument that has caused the controversy so much, has it? or has it?
Well, no, it depends on where the controversy lies. For popular readers, there's a lot that comes across as controversial, from little things like where Jesus was born to big things like what Jesus's goals were. I think the controversy comes from the fact that what I try to do is unearth the obvious political ramifications of Jesus's statements, Jesus's seemingly religious statements. And in doing so, try to point out that, he may not have been the pacifistic preacher of good works with no interest in the cares of this world that he is so often viewed as being in the modern world.
Right. So did some of this controversy, you know, sort of surrounding the Fox News interview and similar issues, come as a surprise to you, or did you kind of know that writing about Jesus in the United States?
Right. No. Listen. Look. I knew. Of course, I knew what I was writing, and of course, I understood that some people would find it controversial and provocative, and react negatively towards it. That response hasn't primarily been by Christians. On the contrary, it's been sort of the usual suspects, the kind of anti-Muslim chorus on the far right that has attacked this book the way that they've been attacking everything that I've done for the last decade. So I'm not surprised by that. If you ask me, is there anything in the criticisms or the reactions of the book that has been surprising to me? There has been. And it's been this weird attack on my credentials that I did not expect from the mainstream, from my colleagues, in fact. That surprised me. It didn't surprise me when Glenn Beck, who, you know, doesn't know anything about any subject, started attacking my credentials because he doesn't understand how academia works. I get that. It surprised me that, colleagues and mainstream news outlets began attacking my credentials. Something, by the way, that never happened when I wrote my previous books on religion. Just all of a sudden started happening when I happened to write about Jesus. And despite the fact that these attacks have been repeatedly answered by every university that has ever educated me and every university that has ever employed me, for some reason they're still there. And it just kind of indicates this odd obsession with attacking the messenger and not the message, you know, the writer and not the book itself. That came as a surprise.
So in that context, do you see the criticism as falling within the broader context of, you know, Islamophobia or discrimination, or do you see it as more an isolated kind of?
No, I think it falls in the larger thing of, let's not take this book seriously. So Right. Let's not take this book seriously because the guy writing it is a Muslim. Let's not take this book seriously because the guy writing it has some agenda against Christianity. Let's not take this book seriously because the guy has no business writing it because his credentials are suspect. It's all the same thing.
Yeah. So how have you handled some of these older or long-term personal attacks, like people from Pamela Geller and others? Or have you just ignored them entirely?
Well, I'm of the opinion that people like Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer, the sort of mavens of the Islamophobia industry, are clowns, and that the proper response to a clown is laughter. So I just make fun of them. You know, I think they're hilarious, and I just mock them as much as I possibly can. But nevertheless, I mean, I do recognize that it can be quite serious. I get a large number of death threats from these people. And now that kind of my family has been insinuated into some of my work because of the fact that, you know, my wife is a Christian, even she's getting these weird attacks, you know, via email and on social media. So, I would be lying if I said that it doesn't bother me, but you know, it bothers you and you move on.
So death threats, it's gone as far as death threats?
Oh, I've got an entire folder of death threats that goes back a decade.
And what has been the main theme of them? Like, what do they hate you for?
Mostly just for being a Muslim. Yeah, not for anything else. Just, you know, threats about me and my Muslim friends, and how, you know, they're going to kill us all and go back to Arabia, which is my favorite one.
So just for being all Muslim.
Yeah. I've never even been to Arabia, so I don't even know. I'd love to go to Arabia, but...
So, I mean, before we conclude, I did have some broader questions that you touched on earlier about, you know, being a public intellectual and issues around popular writing. And so how do you think academia in general views popular writing or public intellectuals, and has, I mean, I know what the climate was like.
Yeah.
Do you think it's changed in some way? Or
well, at best, they tolerate them and dismiss them as dilettantes. as unserious. At worst, they openly deride them. And I think that that's something, I mean, I talk to graduate students a lot about this. The problem with academia, the reason there is such deep anti-intellectualism in American society, and that, by the way, is the core of what happened with the whole Fox News controversy. I think that that got lost, is that it wasn't just the idea that a Muslim was writing about Jesus that I think confused Fox News. It was the idea that a scholar of religions could write objectively, or as objectively as is humanly possible, about a religious figure. And that sentiment, that distrust of scholarship, is not Fox's fault. It's our fault.
Right.
It's the fault of we academics who spend all of our time in our dusty libraries speaking to each other in an incomprehensible language that nobody else could understand, let alone possibly, you know, be interested in. It's the fault of we academics who, when one of us does try to break through the ivory tower and speak to a larger popular audience, becomes immediately tagged as unserious, as not really an academic. And those are, you know, accusations that I have gotten, you know, my entire career. I think that that is changing. When I speak to graduate students especially, what I see is this desire for them to have a role in the public marketplace of ideas, to take the things that they are learning and studying, things that have important contemporary real world implications, and to apply them in the media, in the public realm. So I think what I'm saying is that I feel optimistic about the sort of younger and newer generation of academics who are entering these fields, regardless of the discipline. And I hope that there is a tide that's turning, wherein my colleagues will recognize that they have something valuable to contribute to the public dialogue, and that unless they are willing to try to distill their ideas, to simplify it, to make it appealing and accessible, then they're going to sort of think themselves into irrelevance, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, because the reaction you received from your colleagues after the first book came out, arguably wouldn't have happened if it was just a journal article or some other academic publication, right? Was it partly that it was a popular press and popular book? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I hear this all the time from when I do readings or talks. There are often, you know, fairly well informed people in the audience, and someone will say, you know, didn't Marcus Borg say X, Y, and Z? And didn't John Dominic Cresson agree with this and that? And didn't John Meyer do this and Richard Horsley do that, et cetera, et cetera? And again, what I often remind them is, yes, what I am doing is taking their words, their thoughts, their ideas, building upon them, certainly, and reinterpreting them, certainly, but making them accessible to other people. I mean, these are very, very good scholars, very, very good thinkers who have been deeply influential in my work and in my studies. But the reason that no one outside of we specialists have ever heard of them is precisely because of their either inability or refusal to make their thoughts and ideas more accessible. Mm.
So maybe for the benefit of, you know, the increasing pool of starving doctoral graduates, how did you, or what advice would you have in terms of how to make the transition into popular writing and into popular publishing? Are there any tips of the trade in that sense?
Do what you did for your, okay, take what you did for your dissertation and then do the exact opposite. So that's the best advice that I can give you.
But I mean, it's not easy to break into getting an agent and, you know, finding all that kind of stuff either, right?
It's not as hard as it sounds. I mean, there are millions and millions of agents, you know, in the world, all looking to bring on clients. All you need is to have something that's appealing that they would be interested in reading. But it's not, I mean, I know it sounds like this kind of thing, like, oh my goodness, like, you know, getting an agent, that seems like, that's like getting discovered by Hollywood. Well, it's not, actually. There are millions of agents, and that's what they do for a living, and they're looking for interesting material. And I think the way that you find an agent is that you find people who are writing books that are kind of like the books that you want to write, authors who are kind of like you, and you find out who their agents are, and you send to them because you know that they're already interested in this kind of material. And you know, it's really not much more complicated than that.
When you say do the exact opposite of what you did for your dissertation, is that just your style of writing?
Or and your audience. You know, I often say that a dissertation is a piece of writing that only three people on Earth would be interested in, your dissertation committee. And so what I'm saying is write a book that everyone else would be interested in, that you know, that distills. I mean, I think my second book is a really good example of that. My dissertation is unreadable. You know, it's all very complex terminology, you know, facts, data, figures, things like that. The popular version of it is just the conclusions.
I mean, so is it a different? You wouldn't go as far as to say that it's a different skill set altogether, that your academic training has kind of been pivotal in popular writing as well.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, I beg people to please read my notes. You know, I try to embed my methodology and hide my research as much as possible because the popular readers aren't interested in those things. But I always include them at the back of the book so that they are not disrupting, but they are still there. In fact, I wish that people would do it more often. I mean, I look at a lot of the criticisms I get from my colleagues and some of them even admit openly. I mean, I remember one reviewer who's a Bible professor at Barnard who wrote a review of the book who just openly admitted that she didn't read the notes. she said, well, you know, I wish they were footnotes so they were easy to follow. Well, if they were footnotes, nobody would have bought the book. but they're there. And if you're going to criticize, you know, my scholarship, you should probably read that scholarship first. But, you know, it is what it is, as they say.
Well, sounds great. So, Reza, thanks again for talking with us. I wish you continued success with the book and have fun with the book tour.
Thanks, Amar. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, published by Random House in 2013. Please join us next time.